Welcome to the Movement Podcast. This show is all about movement. We tackle it from different angles, bring on guests, answer questions, go on a few tangents, and give practical advice, giving you guys a better idea of how you can optimize the human body to be the best it can be. Let's preview what's coming up in this episode. We're back with our season two premiere. In this episode, Gray and Lee sit down with Brian Wen. Brian's resume includes head athletic trainer for the LA Avengers, assistant AT for the Jacksonville Jaguars, as well as coach and trainer for many movies, including The Longest Yard, Semi-Pro, Invincible, and The Fighter, to name a few. Brian has worked with many actors from Mila Kunis to Dwayne Johnson, but he's best known for being Mark Wahlberg's personal trainer. We discuss working with high-profile athletes and celebrities and details of working with Mark on set and during his day-to-day. We dive into finding a middle ground between strength and conditioning specialists and athletic trainers. Brian explains going through the Gray Cook experience and offers up insight on boutique fitness and other California trends. We've got a packed show today, so let's get rolling with the Movement Podcast, powered by FMS.
So, Brian, really great to have you. A celebrity trainer. I heard you say that once, and tell me what that even means. Are you the celebrity?
First of all, I would never say that, okay? Because I would only refer to myself as an athletic performance coach. It's the rest of the world that wants to say celebrity trainer. Hey, I ain't going to do – those are semantics. Doesn't matter. What's important is the aspect of professionalism. And I think that's the – whenever I hear those words, I always ask – I always get into my own head – and say, what does it take to be a celebrity trainer? Oh, you mean what does it take to be professional?
Right.
You know, it is. That's what I didn't go out in search for. Oh, I'm going to work for Mark Wahlberg. That's my goal. I want to work for The Rock. I want to go and work with, you know, it never was like that. I just wanted to make Gatorade for the team. And, you know, if they won, I wanted a ring too.
Well, it's outcomes. It's, you know, if you're a professional and you get the job done, people are going to hear about it.
It is exactly my point. And being that guy on the sideline, being that, you know, unspoken variable was always the point. And so having great mentors, Jeff Schatt, Dale Rudd, these were the head athletic trainers at UCLA during my time. And it was, you know, they come from Purdue. They come from, you know, a line of get it done. Just get it done. You know, it's got to get done. And that whole mentality of you're going to get everything done, you know, because that's what the profession is. It's about being there for your team as an athletic trainer. That's the profession I'm speaking about. And they would always talk about professionalism. You know, clean up the station of Gatorade. If there's spilled Gatorade, how does that look like to you, to us? You know, we cleaning up the tape counter. If you felt any of that adhesive on that tape counter, you're wiping it off, scrubbing it away. And then when the rookies come around, you give them shit and you give those people crap and you maintain
culture,
that level of professionalism. That's what I did.
You know, what are some of the expectations then? I mean, does it change? So, you know, Gray and I, you know, we've been fortunate to go into professional sports and work with those athletes. And in my honest opinion, it doesn't change what I think him and I do. As far as I started out working with high school athletes, treat them the same way as you treat the professional athletes. I mean, has the expectations changed when you're working with a Mark Wahlberg?
Well, I will say that the minute I started working with the Jacksonville Jaguars and there was this, okay, now it's the big leagues. Then there is that thing in the back of your head, someone else wants your job. Someone else wants your job.
Yeah.
And so there was this intense need to justify why I was there. It's like Greg Rose. You know, he said, I'm going to be the golf guy. He claimed it, but then he started needing to get those clients. He started needing to read those golf books. He started needing to train with those. Same thing. It's like, once I got there, once I was in the NFL, they were offering, you know, continuing education. You know, I went to go hear Sue Falzone talk, you know, about when she was with the Dodgers and this, and that brought me into the functional movement and, you know, all these little pieces, but it was all continuing education. It was asking for more and being in an environment that was able to provide it. And then once I felt like, all right, I'm ready to be a head athletic trainer myself. Then it was about finding those opportunities and going out there. And it so happened that it brought me back to Los Angeles with the LA Avengers. And that's the whole celebrity thing that came about because they needed a professional football athletic trainer to work a movie set. I didn't know what it was. Could have been any TV show. We're in Hollywood, right? So I just head over there. And it just so happened that I met the producer for someone's for The Longest Yard and their sports stunt coordinator, Mark Ellis. And there was Adam Sandler.
But you know what I see in that transition from sports to actors is in both situations, you are a sports medicine advisor. Mm-hmm. You are an exercise advisor. You're a life coach, a nutrition advisor, a counselor, whatever. And in both cases, these people aren't interested in fitness if it doesn't make them perform better. The actor has a performance standard that the good ones will always adhere to. There's no bad day here. Athletes are the same way. And I think, Brian, that you figured out a way to make, if you're going to be the guy that puts somebody on a program, if these performers, these top-end people who are very self-critical or they wouldn't be where they are, they know when they've been optimized, they know when their state of readiness has been changed, and they know who gave it to them. And so when you're delivering exercise programs and workouts to performers, they're not asking for entertainment. They're asking for transferability. And I think at no time did you ever think your job was less than that. So when you say professionalism, the one thing I want everybody to hear is never once did this guy think he had to entertain somebody with exercise. They are so sensitive to their craft that if he did something to physically optimize them, they were self-aware. And if they weren't, you made them self-aware by screening them or testing them or confronting them, but in a way that they knew this guy renders a performance advantage. You know, John Terrine taught me that. Greg Rose taught me that. When you truly work with performers, mm-hmm. all right, when you work mm-hmm. with posers, they just need a good workout and they need to post that they had a good workout. That's different. There's nothing wrong with that because you entertain them with activity, which was probably better than what they were going to get entertained with.
But I would assume a lot of actors want to be posers. I mean, when you started working with some of these guys, I'm assuming they want to, it's all about aesthetics. How am I going to look on film? I mean, they're not out there literally picking up stuff. I mean, they're acting. So how do you?
You find the athlete within them, right? I think any great coach, it's not about jamming what you know and, you know, trying to prove, you know, you're right. It's about finding, you know, you got to listen to them. There's a goal. It's a story. And if you can dissect and really understand their story, then you join their story. And that's just like how it was for Mark or any other clients. I think, you know, as a passionate strength coach, you better learn
you build the
basics. Yeah.
You build the
trust. You trust. It's not about, it's, you know what it is? I trust myself in regards to that. You know, you have to, as an athletic trainer and you're calling shots and you're doing, you have to trust yourself. And if you don't trust yourself, you can't trust anybody else. You can't love yourself. You can't love anybody else. And I think if you are, you know, without that rhetoric in your head, you know, you're not enough, you can't get there, and really understanding that that's all lies that you tell yourself, that really, if you put your heart and soul into it, I believe I'm a great athletic trainer, that I know I am. I wouldn't have gone through what I've gone through, but it wasn't something that I just found. I had to work for it. And then because of that dedication, and you know, there's another, whoever it is, they're there, they're in a movie, I trust that they've been along a great journey too. It's whatever has gotten them there. And now whatever we can do together, let's go and let's build that together. Let's be better. But that communication about, I'm not meeting you as somebody here that knows more. I'm meeting you face to face and eye to eye. And we're just both, we both eat, we both crap. We both, you know, and that level of humanity has brought me closer to my clients than any, oh, I have. Would you like to list of my qualifications, my certification? Do you know who I know? Like, as I've matured, I realize I just have real relationships. And so I absolutely believe that if you're a coach, an athletic trainer, whatever, you are there as a person in that person's corner. You're their corner team. You're their athletic trainer. You're their healer. You're their whisperer, their listener. And if you can be heart first, I guarantee you it'll take you places, but I couldn't have found my heart if I didn't find my heart alongside the people who made that athletic training room such an amazing place to be. I worked over 40 hours of volunteer work a week, but because I love the people, I thrived and I grew. And now this day I'm reaping those rewards, and people will say, it's like, what did you do? I was like, what are you talking? I busted my ass for
up.
Something that I was
show
passionate
up,
about.
You like what you're doing, and it's definitely paid off.
And those referrals, you know, being, you start to expect more of yourself. You know, you're in the light. So you know, it's about showing up there. It's like, I may not know everything, but let me check on that and let me get back to you. As I start to have more clients, I didn't know that much about golf. Bo's a golfer. So what do I want to do? Let me get over to a TPI. Let me start figuring something. Let me talk to my boys that are doing this stuff. Let me figure out SFMA because of that. You dig part of all the things that you do because of the people that you have in your head. And that's what ended up just growing more. And I just trusted that energy.
Keep educating yourself. Keep the culture. Keep
and
it light.
That is true, right? It's that.
You're a student of service, man.
You are a student of service. You got to listen to, you know, you'll listen to your heart and the universe provides. Yep. God, Allah, whatever your energy is, it came from your creation and that creativity inside. So I believe in it, and that's how we got here. And if you can do that for yourself, you can do it for others, and I guarantee you the more and more will be given to you so that you can share your gift.
So, Brian, give us a little bit more insight. How do you train these high-profile celebrities? Do you do much different with them?
Well, you know, as I was saying, you got to be professional. You're professional. You know, you subjective, objective, assessment, plan. All right.
You got a process. Got a system.
Hey, it's worked. They taught it to me at day one on the training room when I was writing things down, and to this day still use it. And those objective measures are super key. You know, those are the when I get to show off a little bit of, I show off my in-body machine. I bring this FMS board. You know, if it's an athletic movie, meaning I got to get the actor ready, here comes my YBT board. You know,
what do those guys say? Like a Mark Wahlberg, you walk in with a test kit and say, step over this string, stand on this board. I mean, what are they looking at?
Well,
like, crazy?
Yeah, but of course, you got to present it the right way. I want to tune you in. I want to make you as elite as possible for that to happen. I got to find out where, you know, what the weakest link is. Where can I fill the gap? You also have to know how to talk to their psyche, right? So, and when I say there, I mean, if you can really understand people's archetypes, et cetera, like I would say Mark Wahlberg fits somewhere in between warrior and royal. And so I don't really like saying, that's not so good. There's opportunity. But really, I just always like telling Mark, that was great. And then write that down and then make a note, you know, how'd I score? You scored amazing. All right. That's pretty much it. I don't leave anything else it's 14. It's exactly what I was looking for. That language definitely has to come into play. The funny story in that one, the first screen I ever did with Mark, he wanted me to show him first. I was like, I'm going to describe it to you. I'll show you once, but I really don't want to try and show. It's not really, I really want to get a great look. It's like, no, show me. I had to show him. Then he had, you test this person first. So then I had to test, you know, Andy first. And
he's studying for the test.
He did. So then Ace, you know, I'm 1-0. Ace does not move. Like he is, oh. So then Mark steps at the plate and he goes, that was a 3. He's telling me that right there, that was a 3. Like, dude, E, come here. I got a 21. Check this out. And, you know, so I'm like, hell yeah, you did. In the back going, oh my God, we got an 8 on the score. I was like, oh, you know, it's like pain on the shoulder and it turns. But that's the thing, right? He doesn't have to understand my thing. It's just about that. So if I can stay focused with what my plan is, and we're going to the same place, but there is a play of as someone on a movie set or someone on a team, everybody's trying to make this great film, and you're going to do what you got to do as a professional to make that happen for the film. And I definitely have done that. There's, you know, I don't want to fight with anybody. I don't want to put anybody down. I want to make them feel great. So if an in-body can get that number, that body fat is always a thing in Hollywood.
Yep.
And so you have to understand your P's and Q's when it comes to nutrition and be able to lay out a plan. So, you know, if I had food journals, I have my own specially made food journals for, you know, it has my name on it and all that stuff. So look as professional as you do when you hand out the things. On the back of that book is a referral card everybody's looking for feedback.
You know, I think something you said there is a good message I want people to hear. In the early days of movement screening, a lot of people would be inspired by our workshops. They would get movement screened in a workshop. Mm-hmm. I love it when professionals personally consume the thing that they're getting ready to distribute to other people. But I think people thought that that teaching moment that you're waiting for is not when you've got all the numbers for the screen and you tell Mark what he did good and bad on. It's the way you change the workout based on what you learned. Mm-hmm. And whether you tell him his number or whether you downplay the number and say, I did all those 7 screens to find the one that seemed to be the thing that's going to change the quickest. Ooh, that sounds like an opportunity, not a problem. Mm-hmm. So I see you doing that in a very natural way, but I realize going over somebody's screen is not reading them their score sheet. It's introducing them to that first movement path that may actually help them become aware of the one that you just measured in a very reliable way.
That's true. So knowing those weaknesses, I knew exactly which exercises would
It's like you got
smoke.
A crystal ball yeah, the someone, next time they work out.
But someone like Mark, yeah. You know, who obviously has trained isolated training, bicep curls, does a lot of training historically. You come along, mm-hmm. and I would assume you introduced a whole different way of looking at training and thinking about yes. not just going into the gym and moving a bunch of weights, but everything. Is that safe to say?
Well, this is a beautiful story right here. When I first met Mark, it was for the movie Invincible. I didn't train him for that at all. He came from the movie Departed. In fact, he was still finishing up some reshoots with the Departed, so he had to bulk up. And so he was super heavy up top.
He had to bulk up for the Departed?
Yeah, he bulked up a lot for the Departed. Because when you're a Boston cop, you've got to be strong.
And eat donuts.
Nice.
Yeah. Who the fuck do you think you are? Can you edit that out? Sorry.
Of course not.
He's out in the field, first day, and he has a little calf strain, right? So he comes in to see me. And I had already met him
beforehand. He had a calf strain on the field.
He had a calf strain on the field. And for the movie, we were doing practice for the scenes. This is the first day of getting the choreographed team and the actor together. And so Mark is mirroring what the stunt doubles have been practicing along with the rest of the thing, because everything on the field is choreographed. Otherwise, people are going to be running into all of them. So Mark is making his run cut, and he kind of feels a little zinger on the calf. I'm like, oh, we can't keep going because that's just going to turn worse and production is going to stop. So we stop him there. It's my first chance to actually, check him out. So I do the checkout. I do my
an athletic trainer hat and go out there and with your scissors and tape.
I put a little my little portable stim. I did the little ice, and from then they took my contact. I had to see him the next day for a little treatment, and it was immediate. I was automatically kind of like the guy helping out Mark because we production couldn't stop, and when I went deep into the actual screen, and then I saw all the opportunities. You kind of look at the environment. Mark traveled with 2 trailers, all just
isolated equipment.
Fixed.
He's bodybuilding.
Just that's it.
Yeah.
And so I had to have a hard conversation with him after he had strained his groin. Literally the week after, he's like, "What's up with I'm working out. I'm doing the thing." I'm like, but you see, the way we train in this sport is this way. And it was that
training to move versus training to show.
Exactly. So. It was just, and it was like, we do a little bit more of our, functional training stuff. And, back then it was, JC Santana books and, though that kind of like, we have a lot of those bands and a lot of chops, a lot of lifts.
A lot of reps with a little weight doesn't impress anybody.
All good. But at least we were doing bird dogs, at least we were doing those things.
You probably show him stuff he couldn't do and he didn't like it.
Exactly. He didn't, but that was the rehab part. So I was able to get in and do some bird dogs with him because that was the rehab for the groin and hamstring work that I was doing, him doing those with hydrants. Remember those hydrants we used to do? Now that I look back at my days, I'm sorry for the side. I did hydrants horrible. I was teaching people how to lean to the side to get their leg up. And I was teaching people how to compensate. I can't even believe I can't even. Sorry, I digress. So So Mark got on the whole, got onto this thing. And after we were done with the movie, we'd done shooting, and we had built this relationship over the course of the 6 weeks. He just kind of pulled me aside. I'd love to, you know, I kind of want you because
you could do both. You could help him's body.
I'm going to end up going home to a bunch of equipment that you're saying I really shouldn't use if I want to do this boxing movie. And if I want to do, you know, this action movie over here where I'm playing, you know, all these sports movies, and he's got to be on camera.
With the exact same effort, you can look well and move well, or just look well with the exact same effort.
Well, that's, but you can tell, you know, when Mark had to, you know, if it's not Mark on camera, he didn't want that on there, you know? So he wants to be the runner. He wants to be, and that's how he's always been. You know, he wants to do as much as he can. So,
and it's very interesting because that's no different than you break it down. That's what everybody wants. Everybody wants to be healthy as long as they can. For someone like that, whether it's a pro athlete or a celebrity, they just have to be healthy as long as they can to make money.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the bottom line.
It pays. It's there. This is the tool. Neasy, you're taking care of number one. He would say that. You're taking care of number one. You can go wherever you want. If you're with the bigs, you better be able to answer the questions that the bigs ask you. And, you know, you better be able to show.
Yeah, they can sift through shit really quick.
If you don't, I don't know many people that really are that great of bullshitters, especially in this industry, that can, you know, I'm just going to BS my way. And then when it comes down to show, it's like, oh, okay, what are you going to do? I mean, one of the sayings that I love from one of my celebrity is if you can't show me, you know, blow me. It's like, I don't want to see anything, you know, you can't, you know, so if you can't do it. And it made a lot of sense. It's like, why shouldn't I be able to do these things well and be able to really demonstrate, you know, I got to be an example to, and a mirror to what it is I'm trying to preach to the world.
That's one of the things we started doing on stage. We were one of the first people talking about movement, and we would call somebody up on stage and say, you can't touch your toes. Voila, now you can. And everybody else, when they were posed with a movement question, would talk about the most recent research or recent article. But I'd gotten a lot of my manual therapy skills up in Canada, and it was a whole different thing. It was an experience where, oh, what do you do when somebody can't rotate left? Have I got anybody in the classroom that can't? Yeah, me. Mm. Bring them up on stage. Right there. And Lee and I have always taught through that visual example, because most people who need us and most people who are like us are kinetic learners. We add more value to one move than most people do, because just like a musical note or an artistic expression, the artist is doing more. We do that with movement. So I can appreciate dance. I didn't say I was a good dancer, but that we're visually attached to that. So when I bring somebody up on stage and do something like help their squat or help their toe touch, it's not about me. And actually, it's not about their therapy. It's for everybody in the audience to see I'm taking action on what I just said. It happens this quick if you line up the dominoes, and it doesn't if you don't. And we've never done that to showboat the message. We've done it to basically demonstrate opportunity is like 6 inches away from you, you know? But I do think that the true professionals who are going to pay the prices that you deserve to charge, they're going to squeeze. They're going to demand that performance because people demand it of them. Yes. And so they're like, if you're going to be on my team, you got to go when we go.
Absolutely. So, yeah. The word that comes to mind is, you know, efficiency. You
don't waste my time.
Yes. I only have a certain amount of time. And if I really want to get what I want to get done in the time I want to get done, it's not about a 3-hour session. That doesn't make it, you know, a better one. It's about
quality over quantity.
I got to get in and I got to get out. I don't need anybody thinking about me like, oh my God, I got to do a whole 2-hour workout right now. It's you know, 4 a.m. club is I'm in at 4. We start at 4:30. By 5:30, I'm on the road. At 6 a.m., I'm back home with my family before traffic started. That's how the 4 a.m. club got started, but that's efficient. And, you know, you build that consistency in, and you get the commitment. That's all for all you coaches out there. If you can do the basics and the simple really well, and you know what works, come on now. Minimum dosage effect will tell you that that's how you change.
And you can do it at 4 a.m., you're in the club.
Well, if you can show up at 4 a.m. with dragon energy and wake someone up, then they want you all the time that, hey, if I get started and that much light shows up and I feel that much better when I start my day, that's what's going to happen. You know, that's That's what you hope for.
All right. So going back a little bit to, we talked about the screen and how we use that to evaluate and kind of maybe even check some egos, kind of see where someone is physically. However, I think some of the audience, we talked about the score and we talked about threes and ones. Could we maybe just quickly elaborate on kind of what that means and what a score kind of looks like and how you go forward with that?
Yeah.
Well, it's really easy when you're in a high profile environment for the person who is the superstar in the room, athlete, actor, whatever, to feel that the goal on a screen is to have perfection, right? And threes are actually an exceptional expression of movement. And the more you do and the older you are, the worse chance you have of doing that because cars have miles on them. If you can simply get an average score, we found out that whether you're a high profile athlete or whether you're a weekend warrior, an average score can get you to the Hall of Fame of the best sport in the world. What we find out is if you're not aware of what your score is, it's just as important as what your score is. So a three is really better than average. A two is a firm base to build almost in any direction. And a one means you're going to have greater difficulty than somebody who doesn't have a one doing the same thing in the same amount of time with the same efficiency with the same amount of risk. It's just going to be, I'm not saying you can't do it, but your trunk is loaded with concrete. Your car's just going to drive a little different today. And so people need to see that. It's not perfection here, but on an eye chart, there's always a three, but nobody gets a three on an eye chart because there's a thing called 20/10 vision. A lot of baseball players actually have it, but nobody's going for exceptional on an eye chart. They're going for 20/20. And in the movement screen, you see a lot of twos, think 20/20. You see threes, think, you know, maybe, but it doesn't guarantee anything. You see a lot of ones, it does guarantee on a big scale, probably more missed and failed opportunities. And that's all it is.
It's really not about the high score. You're not going for the score. It's there as a magnifying glass for you to find those gold nuggets. And the gold nugget, your client doesn't have to understand the gold nugget. You do. And that's the thing that, you know, I made that mistake as FMS rookie that I want to show people, oh, this is here and this is here and this means this and this means this and da-da-da-da-da. And then all of a sudden, that client is just disenamored by what's going on. And then it absolutely is. And I started realizing, like, you know, I sell a hell of a lot more memberships when I don't talk about the results of the FMS.
If you can have a movement conversation without words with somebody, they will walk away thinking they had the most amazing experience. I didn't say you couldn't use some words, but if you will cut your words in half and cut your experience, elevate your experience, then you'll find you can't have an experience if you don't have a perspective at the front and end of that experience. So we say test, retest. But what we're really saying is a magic trick's getting ready to happen, and I don't even know which one it's going to be. Mm-hmm. But if we baseline you here and I call upon my resources here, in about 10 minutes, we'll make an adjustment. What people don't get is I didn't make an adjustment on your tissue. I made an adjustment on your central nervous system.
Yep.
And if we make that adjustment a few days in a row and you start helping out with better habits, we will make an adjustment in your tissue by next month. But your central nervous system just said, I like what you just did because something that you didn't just train or instruct got better. That means the system optimized based on your intervention, even in something you didn't touch.
And exactly on that energy, that's what design, I use the FMS to quote unquote design our warm-up. I always used to call it, this is going to help us. So our retest was always hey, we need a new warm-up this 2 weeks.
Nice.
And then I would design our warm-up. So it would show up. I'd always-
Never called them corrective, did you?
No. Oh, no.
There
what?
You go.
Yeah. No, it's our warm-up. Yo, Neasy, what are we doing to warm up today? It's right there on the board. We got ankle swings, 20 of them. You got a crawl. We got a thing. We got our power plate squats. We used to do our squat to stands on our power plate, you know, and that was like, you remember, keep those feet pushing in that vibration. If a lot of coaches really understood that the win of the FMS is getting it done, taking the screen,
movement, blood pressure.
Keep doing it. And give it that power because it is. Those gold nuggets are in there. And the more and the deeper you walk into that assessment lane, the more you can start to understand the screens that come through it, whether it's SFMA for practitioners or FCS. Like, you are just building into that whole understanding your clients more.
The feedback's for you. What you do with it depends on who the client is, what the situation is, what the goal is, but the feedback's for you.
Yeah.
How much of that you share is pretty much like an airline pilot up in the front of the cockpit. He's not sharing every piece of information, hey, just the stuff that makes you think he's competent.
I have a great steak at Maestro's, you know, once every year, you know, maybe for birthday or maybe for Sinley's birthday, but I never ask for recipes. I don't ask him. I don't go back to the kitchen and ask him how he cooks this.
This is where the great steak is.
I just enjoy the meal, baby. And if you can do that with your clients and you don't have to discuss with them how you cook this and do this and all these other things, and you just give them a great meal, I guarantee you, man, you'll be cooking for a long time in your life.
Yep.
So I did have one question. We mentioned, or you mentioned earlier, the 4 a.m. club, right? That is an impressive feat, and I'm sure most people would agree with that. However, I'm just curious, in order to be somewhere at 4 a.m., what time do you go to bed?
Great question. This is a great question. When I was doing 4 a.m. club, there was no way that I was going to be able to make it by holding onto a full client list because, you know, having the children, you know, I've got the responsibilities of a father. I'm not going to go to bed at 7-8 mark, who has, you know, the support, the help. You know, he could go to bed at 7 a.m. or right after dinner, and that's what that guy does. And he always talks about, you got to get your 8 hours. You got to get strong. That's how we get. During that time we're sleeping. That's the reset, Neasy. You taught me that. It's like, okay, yeah, you're right. But then, you know, do as I say, don't do as I do. So here I am in the very first couple of weeks, you know, struggling, dying until I realized that I needed that midday nap. Once I started doing the midday nap, 4 a.m. was just, oh, easy. I'd go 4 a.m. club, come home at 6. By 10 a.m. after the kids are at school and all that stuff, boom, I just let myself go to sleep. I'd go to sleep for hour and a half, 2 hours, depending on whatever I needed. I just let my body go. And then I'd wake up and just feel refreshed. And that's what carried me through. So just being able to kind of like split that up and get the power nap was so helpful. But to say, oh yeah, I start just going to bed at 8 o'clock, I would be lying. Yeah. 4 a.m. club started because of that schedule. I needed to get back on the road by 6. Otherwise, I can't go be dad. And my priority is being dad. So, you know, how do you want to make this happen? He said, okay, well, I'll wake up earlier. Let's just wake up earlier. And so that's what we did. He was up so early. We worked out by 6. By 5:30, we're done. 6 o'clock, you know, he's off on the way to the golf course because his tee time is 6:30. So it all works out at the end of the day. It was just like, this is perfect. Everybody's happy. And there was no more dilly-dallying. You know, I don't get if he can be on the course by 6:30, I can be on the road. I can be home. Yes. So everybody wins. And I'm going to sacrifice the 8 hours straight for this nap. Yes. So I got to bed by 10:30. And then that gave me what? If I wake up at 3, woke up at 2:45, 15 minutes to get ready, left at 3, was at his house by 3:45. So, you know, I would get, 4 hours of sleep, 4 or 5 hours of sleep, if that, maybe. So it was cut up, but you do what you got to do. And thank God I was, you know, in the 30s.
All right, let's take a break. And when we come back, Brian and the guys will discuss sports medicine and strength and conditioning from their vantage point.
FMS One is designed for fitness, healthcare, and performance professionals who are looking to evaluate and understand how well their clients, patients, and athletes move. This is a highly interactive certification course that equips you with the tool industry leaders use to guide their programming decisions. During this course, you will learn how the 7 fundamental patterns of the movement screen relate to and affect many of our daily activities, and how mobility, motor control, and functional pattern concepts play a role in the screening process. You'll be able to identify correct screening techniques and common mistakes so your screen results are consistent and reliable. The FMS1 learning environment consists of a movement lab, performing the screen with your peers, and engaging in screening demonstrations with your instructors. Are you ready to have a reliable tool that sets a movement baseline and provides a tight feedback loop to guide your programming decisions? Take a look at our upcoming courses and get started today.
Okay, just quick little historical perspective. I graduated from PT school in 1990, and I also became a strength coach that very same year. That was a rare thing, but something that was customary. And I didn't become a strength coach so I could be a strength coach. I became a strength coach so I could speak strength coach. I'm looking at 240-something ATCs. And even in your age, when you guys came through, it was rare for somebody interested in sports medicine to equally embrace strength and conditioning. You did this working with the same people, dealing with the same problems, making the same forecast, but with two completely different perspectives. The strength coach mentality is usually aggressive and very, very, you know, move forward, ultra conservative over on sports medicine. We're not doing that today. And you somehow, Brian, made that transition into strength conditioning, and you parlayed that sports medicine life coach conservancy with that aggressive coaching into personal training. Lee did the same thing when we started working about it. I was like, you got to become a strength coach. And he knew his career wasn't going that direction, but I'm like, if we can all speak strength coach and hold each other accountable, I think we can figure this thing out. And so that's what I want you guys to speak to, is the fact that your dual credential made each of your interventions better because you can argue both sides of the argument. And that's the one thing I want people to hear us doing, is we can argue both sides, and then we let our heart pick. We make our head know both sides of the coin, let your heart pick.
Mm-hmm. I knew early on I wanted to be in the field of sports medicine. Mm-hmm. And, you know, being able to help people and do the whole thing. And then when I went to college, you know, one of the first things that kind of tipped me to really know I wanted to make this a career, because when you're in college, you really don't know, right? Mm-hmm. So I knew I wanted to make it a career. Is one of the guys, you know, I was working with the track team, and typical hamstring strain, do the whatever. And he was a very, very elite 100-meter guy. And he performed great. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my thought process was like, you know, I had a little something to do with that, him doing it at that level. And from that little is one little meet, really didn't matter, but he was a very high level. That's the one thing that kind of tipped me over to say, you know what, this is the right field for me. And at that point, it was always about reacting to a problem. Even from that point, okay, he strained his hamstring, came to see me. All I get is get him back on the field or get him back on the track. But when I started, you know, with working with Gray, it was with the strength coach mentality, it was like more proactive, mm-hmm. not waiting for someone to get hurt. Being more proactive and being able to mesh those two thought processes together is where I think that any dual credential is taking what you know over here and what you know over here and blending them is what will make everyone a little bit better.
You had great mentors in that training room. And when you are given those responsibilities from your mentors, you know, that admiration, then, you know, you see their names and it's all ATC, CSCS. I always thought CSCS was just like something that, you know, you ended up getting as an ATC because, you know, it's a collection of letters, right? EMT, ATC, CSCS. Is there another one? We got to keep going here. So for me, it was absolutely about, you know, expanding the resume. I want to be able to go and do more. I'm already doing exercise. I already know anatomy. Why wouldn't I? You know, it's duh. It's
well, part of the problem, though, Brian, especially when I was coming through, and Gray and I've witnessed this a lot in what we do consulting, is there's two sides of the hall. There's a strength conditioning side and there's a sports medicine side. And too often those two sides don't connect on any level.
So many arguments.
They battle all the time. And it's got to be, and this is a huge opportunity, I think, where all three of us have really done well, is it's that middle ground. Mm-hmm. It's being able to be in the middle of that hallway and being able to pull people over here. And that is a huge benefit.
Whether you're in a university setting or a professional sports setting, the two sides of the hall. And the funny thing is, we watch the athletes act different in the training room than they do in the weight room. They almost are more themselves in the weight room because it's a little bit closer to practice. And the training room is where you go. That's like the principal's office, mm-hmm. right? When Bill Parcells used to walk in there every now and then and go, nobody's hurt. Everybody get out of here today. You know, that's how you reduce injuries. Nobody's. But my whole point is, some of the teams that we've worked with the most, the athlete doesn't have to change the way they behave in either mm-hmm. room. Both rooms have the exact same goal. You're just at a different place on the conveyor belt today, but they know that it's a seamless transition. That hall is not the Grand Canyon. That hall is just 12 steps. That's the communication and accountability that I knew our clinic couldn't live without, because we didn't have a high budget and we didn't have some of the most popular connections in town. Mm-hmm. We had to basically be eight guys doing no-look passes, between a sports problem and a conditioning problem and have a seamless transition between the injured athlete and the almost ready and the ready athlete. And we just started turning cases in an elegant way, but being proactive on that. And so what we did to ourselves is what people invited us in to do for them. And seriously, if you'll drop your old way of speaking and adopt a way that's just as efficient, you'll find it stacks the dominoes for you. And you start having these conversations that make you realize, I didn't disagree with that person at all. Yeah. We were just using a different word for the same thing.
So, yeah. Brian, you said, you know, you consider yourself an athletic performance
trainer.
Coach.
Oh, athletic performance coach. Yeah.
I mean, that's really, yeah. So, I mean, right now, even though you, what I would say, most people would say you train people, you mm-hmm. are their strength coach, mm-hmm. right? How much of athletic training do you do now? I mean, is this still part of what you do?
I mean, tracking off of what Gray is talking about, when you're able to fully respect, you know, all of the entities, and not just the strength coaches, the athletic trainers, strength coaches, but even the coaching staff makes up a huge influence on what's getting done and who's getting on the field, especially at the pro level. And when I watched Mike Ryan and Jerry Palmieri handle, you know, situations, got to get this guy on the field, we need him now, and then we're putting, but, you know, at the same time, science is science. And if this player is valuable, is it really worth this game? All these business decisions get made over, you know, who's going to be hit the field. And I watching that from afar, I realized, you know, I needed to spend the time with each of these entities. If I wanted to be head guy myself, I had to learn. I had to be. So I was taking the time to be with the media guys. I spent time with the coaches, you know, getting their mentality, you know. Never with Coach Coughlin, he didn't really, but you know, the other coaches, all the position coaches,
right.
You know, but now when I became the head athletic trainer, I was meeting with the head coach every day, and I was a strength coach on that team too. And so being the head athletic trainer and strength coach, there was this play on, okay, what's the priority here under the roof of the Avengers so that we can produce the W that's, you know, that everyone is looking for. So, you know, our athletes left for the off season. And you know, we all came back. They were supposed to do with their workouts, but you know, a lot of them have other jobs. It's arena football. It's, you know, this isn't everything. And so
20-year-olds do what they want.
Hey, you're already in season. My in-season workout isn't, all right, guys, come on, 4 sets, 450 deadlift, and then we got snatches. It's recovery work.
Exactly.
And so, you know, I have head coaches saying, why aren't we banging the steel? You know, like,
yeah, but your background as an athletic trainer lets you recognize that. You recognize
exactly.
That's
the science that I was able to spit back to the coaches. But I did. I will admit, in the Avengers, I did. My background as an athletic trainer made me fall back on athletic training kind of mindset. I was more on the cautious end than they would have liked me to be.
Yeah.
I made the athletic training room so much more beautiful than the weight room. You know, I cared about that training room. I had TV screens. I had my hydroc, everything you learn how to. I had 8 interns for the training room. And I just took whoever wanted to do some learning to the weight room. So I highly prioritized what was happening in the athletic training room.
But it's realized, changed. Yeah. I mean, it's definitely changed over the last 10 to 15 years.
Now where, I know all well, of the no, magic no, is in the weight room.
There's a lot more communication. I mean, when you go into... And I do think that in the 90s, 2000s, strength coaches and athletic trainers, sports medicine didn't communicate as well.
You have now to think on the preventative side now.
And you know what? I have to say this because we watched this happen on our time, on our watch. For every 10 or 20 strength coaches at a high level that embraced what we were saying, maybe one ATC would. And that's not me calling out the profession. I honestly think most athletic trainers at the highest level are overworked and overstressed and overpulled in every direction. But when we started trying to combine that together, I love the way an athletic trainer calculates the state of readiness and the damage that's done after the thing. And I love the way a good strength coach administers stress like a medication to yield a result. And so if you think like a ATC on the beginning and the end of every workout, how are they coming in and what did I do to them? And if you think like a strength coach, how can I create this nutrient of stress that actually leaves them rebounding with good rest and regen as a better version of themselves the next day? And so the two professions are made to actually be exactly like Congress. Duel it out. Tell us what the best of you think. And you know, what Lee and I said is we use the system to say who's in charge today.
Mm-hmm.
If you're injured, sports medicine calls it. If you're not, strength conditioning calls it. And if you make a mistake, you wear and own that mistake. But that's the whole thing. What we used to see is certain players would even get their strength conditioning advice from sports medicine. Mm-hmm. And certain players would get their healthcare advice from strength conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
It may have seemed appropriate in isolation, but it's inappropriate in professional circles. And watching two equally versed professionals be able to deal with that because of the state the person's in. I'm in an injured state or I'm in a non-injured state. That decides who's in charge. Sometimes that offends people, but that usually winds up being a political or cultural situation. This is scientific. And I just think that unfortunately, the strength coaches embraced what we were doing as an economic measure, not as just a performance measure. How can I manage the space and time? Because it gets smaller every year.
Yeah.
The athletic trainers, as Lee said, have been almost taught and fed to be reactionary. And unfortunately, the new world doesn't need reactionary people. It needs proactive people. So, you know, the athletic trainer that can basically say, if I'm going to even utter a word about exercise, I better get more experience in training and exercise than I was given in my triage paramedic sports medicine education. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think ATCs didn't appreciate what we were doing as quickly as strength coaches did.
Yeah.
It was the way they were trained to look at things.
First, I never really come from a background of strength conditioning. I didn't work out when I was younger like that. I was never invited. My sport was volleyball. We didn't go to
neither
the
did Gray.
Yeah. It's
wear a sleeveless shirt, people make assumptions.
He worked on the farm, though. I was home eating bowls of cereal.
Really I heard he Gray castrated pigs.
Yeah. Let's not talk about that. Yeah. Come on, guys. Gosh, you know,
he listened to that episode. I think I threw the discus and played football too, and rode dirt bikes and stuff like that.
I just thought, no, we're not gonna go there. It's just I
got
chills.
You all off your game.
I am. There was a pivot moment for me. You start to see all of the brilliance to the corner of the ring, right? The athletic trainer, the strength coach, your boxing coach, whatever sport there is, you are part of that corner.
Mm-hmm.
When I did the FMS and all of a sudden I realized there was a better bridge of communication to my application of programs of strength coach programs. And then, you know, what I was doing as far as prescribing exercise, I could get players in the same room, right?
Mm-hmm.
Before I wouldn't do that. But the biggest, so having that language, having the ability to assess what needed to be done, and then translating that into the weight room, you know, I now had a system to teach my players, you know, these are what we're working on today for our squat. This is what's going on for our push patterns today. This is what's going on for our pull. And so they were very just up on the board. And if they had injuries, they had these to do. And it just gave a system that made sense. Again, I still didn't prioritize the weight room. It was the weight room, and when I say athletic performance coaches, I'm shied away from athletic training now, more so because, like, I want to be on this side of prevention. I don't want to be the react guy. I've been the react guy. I reacted to one of the worst moments of my life, and it jarred me so. And that it made me, you know, that's the whole, it shifted me into the performance coaching and, you know, Hollywood and things like that, because I was just done being on the field taking care of injuries, because no injury was greater than, you know, what had happened. So that's just by sheer experience, I've learned to love athletic performance coaching so much more, because I feel like if I had, whatever I say to myself, preparing someone for the field isn't putting band-aids on them and just massaging their calf. It's about making sure they're athletic enough and notice how regenerated they are, how rested they are, just to do more for, you know, the health of the athlete on the field. And so I talk about this experience, but you don't know it. Let me share that story. April 10th, 2001, we were playing arena football. The LA Avengers were playing against the New York Dragons. And it was first quarter, we had just scored the first touchdown, and so we were on a kickoff. in that kickoff, our lineman, Al Lucas, you know, made the tackle.
Mm-hmm.
But after the tackle was made, he kind of slumped over weird and rolled onto his back and boom, laid his arm out the side. And he was just laying there on his back. And Al's done that before. He's like, he's a truck. When he's tired, he'll rest on the field. You know, after he gets tackled, he'll be the guy that's like, just laying on the field for the day.
Yeah. Help him with a timeout.
And then he'll get up. And then you'll see his arm go like this, meaning somebody get over here, you know? But if you looked at his leg and you looked at, you know, his NFL career, you know, this is not a guy playing arena football. This is a guy, he's had an NFL career, had a couple of injuries that didn't allow him to, you know, too expensive, too much of a
go
a
back
risk.
To that level.
And yeah. And so here he is in arena football. He's a friend and teammate of 2 years. I get up to him and he's snoring. Like he's like doing this with his mouthpiece. And then he starts snoring. So I'm like, okay, I've been here before. But that's protocol, right? There are the hands,
yep.
And there's the signal.
Yep.
We're in Staples Center, and here comes the ambulance, and here's the emergency team. The doctors are about Dr. Luca Podesta, Dr. William Lang, they're with me. We're all around Al, and you know, the spine boarding process has begun. We're professionals. We practice this. This is not something we haven't done. We've done this together before with, you know, as a team, we've already done this before. Right. But now here's Al, and 2 minutes into spine boarding and the face mask is off and everything, I realize, or Dr. Lang realizes he's not breathing. His breathing has stopped. Okay. So then we get the airway thing. We're trying to get the right. airway. They finally got that in. He's off the field now. We're into the ambulance. It's been, I would say, about 4 to 5 minutes of him not breathing. And then by the time we're at the hospital, it's already been, you know, 16 minutes, whatever, you know, not breathing and being there in that vehicle and just processing what's happened. Cause I know the doctors know, nobody's saying it, but we know.
Yeah.
And I've already dying inside because I don't know what's going to happen. And the game's going on. No one knows, you know? So that day, you know, Al Lucas died in my hands. And I knew it. There was something different, right? You could feel that. That's energy. And so I always, that was the thing. It's like, you know, part of the athletic trainer in me that they died. You know, it's like
the dichotomy of the game going on. I'm like, so much just happened here and the game's just going on. That's crazy.
You know, after this had happened and someone came to me with, you know, hey, my finger's hurting. Can you help me? You know, all of a sudden when you just don't give a shit about anything, any injury, or, you know, that you got to stop. Like, no injury is greater than the one that Al suffered. And he put his life on the line. And one of the things about Al is he always gave me crap about my athletic training room. Because he was the injured guy. I wanted him in my training room to do treatment on him because we had to keep draining his knee, draining his leg. I was like, Al, if you would just come for treatment, hey, no, you ain't ever going to find me no training room. Hell no. I'm from Georgia.
Old school.
Macon, Georgia. You go there. You want to feed me? I'm going to rub some clay on this kneesy, and you're going to find me in that room over there. Because the only way to get better is get stronger. Is what
I mean. Pain is weakness leaving the body. Hey, they believe it.
Al Lucas would rub red clay on his knee for his swelling, and he would go and work out.
Yeah, our dad was on the show. They talked about that remedy.
Of course,
and
he did.
So the way I honor Al, if I was to make Al proud, is to continue that same energetic thread that he gave me when he died, and he gave me new life.
Purpose.
If he doesn't, he left a 3-year-old daughter.
Mm.
All right, he leaves behind a brother. He's all of it for a game. Hell no, it's for the lives of others. And if I can be that energy for him, if I can keep myself healthy, if I can keep myself being part of a change, then now my life and his death means something more than ever. And so I'm not trying to get emotional or anything like that, but I am. But, you know, if you can't find things in your life, the adversity in your life that truly gives you character and makes you who you are, then you, yeah, keep searching, because life will give you the adversity to give you character. Trust me.
You know, it gave me that as a PT. And once I had gotten through the cycle of being a seasonal PT, watching how people get hurt in the spring, getting fit for the summer, getting overweight in the winter. And it's just this cycle. And you see this, and I made a commitment to myself. And it's that sort of mantra that you gave yourself after that. It's got to be important. It's got to be my heart. I'll attach my head to anything my heart does. I'm like, I got to quit. I want to stop treating preventable problems. Mm. I think I'm going to be better on the other side of this, because there will always be problems. But if I'm sitting here treating the preventable ones, I won't have, you know, I'm not. So it made me think about that. How much in my day as a PT service, preventing care, preventative care or whatever, how much am I actually treating stuff that doesn't even need to be treated?
Yeah.
You know, 2 months ago, I could have whispered this in your ear and we wouldn't be here right now.
Yeah.
Or you could be more self-aware about this, or you could actually realize you got 5 risk factors and you're asking me how to lose 30 pounds. There's 4 other risk factors on your problem than being overweight. Ask me about those, or just go ask somebody about that one. But I got tired of having conversations that I know were going nowhere, but I was paid to have those, you know.
They drove me crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you don't realize in this life that that life is suffering, all right, meaning it's not about embracing the suffering and then, oh, I'm just this depressed person. No, we are constantly in a fight of some other battle. And whether that be pain, obesity, you know, I'm not really throwing the ball far enough.
Or switching careers.
Yeah, or switching careers. If you're a coach, really, it's, you know, you have to understand that you're never going to be pain free. That's not the thing. You're never not going to have challenges. It's just how you embrace it. You don't ever experience the thing. You know, you're only experiencing your thoughts of the thing. So I experienced Al's death. Yes. And in the beginning, my thoughts were, I'm a terrible athletic trainer. I don't deserve the athletic trainer license. You know, a player died on my watch. That was a lie. But the truth, right? The absolute truth that changes is, no, are you crazy? That's the thoughts around it are, I am a better athletic trainer, athletic performance coach than ever, because I see a bigger side of life and a bigger side of humanity and a bigger side of connection than other people who haven't experienced that. And, you know, we talked about, I've opened up a gym, you know, that gym, I closed it down. I lost a lot of money, but that experience, the thoughts was, yeah, I'm a terrible business owner. And it just went down.
You just didn't like being inside that.
But the truth is, that's a chapter, and that made me grow. And so whether it's the death of Breck Fitness, the death of Al Lucas, these deaths are the adversities that just continue to make me grow. And I think as we continue to change, whatever, open doors, closed doors, remember that all those things that you learned in the past, it's not about losing it. It's about, like, how did they make you stronger? How did they make you better? License, experience, whatever we talk about.
All right, let's take another break. And when we return, we'll get an inside look at what Brian and Gray have been up to over the past few days together. We'll also get some insight on the surge of small group and boutique fitness trends.
For over 30 years, Functional Movement Systems has been the leader in movement health. We've developed a system that bridges the gap between fitness, performance, and healthcare professionals. Our screen and assessment tools help pros set the course for their clients and patients and gets them moving well so they can continue to move often. The functional movement screen is the foundation of our system and checks vital signs in movement competency through patterns. From youth or professional athletics to the elderly population and everyone in between, the screen is your starting point. The presence of pain is a vital sign we consider in our system. The Selective Functional Movement Assessment, geared toward healthcare professionals, is the diagnostic assessment for individuals experiencing pain during movement or with the screen. Once proper treatment is administered by clinicians, the patients are cleared to resume regular activity. The screen is once again at play to set the movement baseline. But what's next? When an individual displays competency in the screen, it's time to advance to another level, the Fundamental Capacity Screen, which tests for fitness, performance, and capacity. The system identifies whether individuals warrant additional rehabilitation or corrective exercise, or if they're ready for performance-based activity. Decide what course is right for you and get started on your professional journey today.
So, Brian, you've been here for a few days now prepping for this little podcast, and you've had the Gray Cook experience. And by your wardrobe, it looks like you successfully completed the 3 days.
I would say I've done stand-up paddleboard. I've done Indian clubs on a yoga pad.
I like how he calls that the yoga pad. It's basically a little piece of
concrete blocks.
All I saw was Kiana Tom in my youth, and I could remember just that moment, that television program. I'm like, that's what brought me into fitness in the first place. Yeah, let's step it away. Let's go. You know, I'd be like, oh, yeah, this is the greatest. But the yoga pad brought me back to that moment. That was really nice. We started to have a conversation about that. Mm-hmm. We both vibed on that. We threw axes.
Of course.
Oh, yeah. The axe
not, throwing. Not at one really of these axe throwing bars. You're out in the woods throwing real axes.
No, yes. He was drinking bourbon and throwing axes.
Yeah,
of course. That's what you have to have when you throw axes is bourbon.
You don't need a bar for bourbon.
If you don't drink bourbon while throwing axes, you're not really throwing axes, are you? You're playing with like these metal things.
Sometimes the next morning you find an axe out in the yard.
It's crazy because, like, you know, he's sitting there trying to show me how to do the axe throwing. And, you know, the first one, he goes and he's clunk, clunk.
I'm off, man.
And it fell. He's like, oh, hey, you know, hold on. Just this one's a little loose. And, you know, he grabs the other one. Boom. Misses. No stick. I swear. The fourth one, and he was so like, oh, man, it must be these injections I just got. You know, my grip is a little bit off. He goes to grab a couple of different, these blue axes now. These are the ones that you can't mess up. They're weighted so well. Takes the sleeve off. Of course.
I'm like
11 throws in until he finally gets one to stick. And I'm like, yeah, we needed a little bit more bourbon. I think, I don't know. So I was just swinging around.
Then they started sticking.
They started going. Once the wood started softening up, I think that's really what needed to happen. Yeah. You know,
he beat it down.
Hell yeah. Yes, and then he taught me how to do it. And
Whoa. He taught you how to do it?
Oh, yeah.
You let him teach you after that experience?
Oh, hey. He's like,
He missed 11 in a row.
I will tell you right now, the teaching moment was amazing because he let me actually explore and play. He gave me no cue in the beginning, how I love coaching. No cues. Don't tell you. Just let me do it. He gave me permission. He didn't. Boom. I threw a second one. Went way high. You got everything down. Just, he takes a little cottontail thing. I don't even know. Just
blade of grass.
Blade of grass. I don't know, something. He sticks it right in the middle. He goes, you're just too wide.
Aim small, miss small.
Aim small, miss small. And that throw, 2 inches like away from the thing. And I was, Then it just became like, yes, more, more, more. I started getting farther back up. And he goes, you take that with two hands. And boom. And as soon as he left to go to the bathroom, I was 50 feet away throwing this thing, you know, just like, just trying to go. It was so much fun.
Here's a picture of imagery in my head.
Yeah.
You two bozos frolicking around the woods, going from activity to activity.
That's pretty much it. I mean, no,
we saw a bear.
In between each moment, we did a workout at every one of those moments, right? Because I was sitting there. He's not going to do an axe throwing without showing you how it really relates to Indian clubs.
He's not going
to
do anything more than 10 minutes.
He starts standing on a side look. He goes, look, be careful not to hit your knee on this one. I'm like, oh, okay. Indian club, like with the axe. And then if you really just do this natural swing, you'll see how that natural. And he's doing all these, like, you know, it's all really part of the pattern. He's doing his thing. We do a sandbag on the yoga block. That was an amazing flow and kind of like the precursor with the move print stuff. So I was in it. Like, I'm just winning right now. I'm like, yeah, this is great. When we first get to the cabin, this is one of those moments, right? When I realize I'm from LA, you know, I get to the cabin.
That's what it took.
No. You get to the cabin and I'm used to the little flies, you know, little flies. And, you know, when I came here last, you know, and I visited the cabin, Anthony Batiste was with us, and he got stung by a wasp on the way in, going up the stairs. And so there's a lot of these wasp nests around. I'm like, Gray, you don't want to take like no leaf blower and just like, you know,
a leaf blower
or like some wasp leaf blower spray. I'm basically asking, yes, can you please get rid of the wasps?
Andy got stung last time he was here.
Yeah, he got stung and then got stung again on the way downstairs.
He slammed the door and got stung again.
Oh my gosh. And so I didn't want that to be me. I'm like, this is going to be me, right? I'm going to get stung. And so I asked Gray.
That's part of the Gray Cook screening process.
If these wasps are around, how do you get them to not like sting you or bite you or whatever? He goes, well, I just don't sting them. I'm like, okay, that's pretty good then. I just don't bother them. All right, I'll trust it.
Don't let them smell your fear. They'll leave.
Here they are swirling around like
you didn't get stung.
And they what are you talking about? They are. So they are so aware, these little wasps. You come closer, their wings go, zzz, they want you to know.
So what in the world did Anthony do to get stung twice?
Look, wouldn't stop staring at and talking about it.
Yeah.
He kept complaining about it. Yeah, finally got irritated.
Gray screening process. You just gotta go. You get stung by the wasp, then you're not going to make it to the yoga pad.
If you got stung and nobody else did, there's a reason.
All of a sudden, he's tossing up these cans for me, and I'm shooting. And he goes, oi! Like, what the hell was that? What happened? Because I think it's a horse fly.
It's a horse fly.
It's a horse fly. I'm like, a horse fly? What do you mean a horse fly? And he goes, what is that? I'm like, what does that bite feel like? And as soon as I ask those questions, he says, it's a bit wet. And then I hear, ugh! I feel this, ugh! I'm like, oh, that's what it feels like. It literally feels like there's something chewing on you. Yeah. Like
I said, you'll know in a minute. And he's like, ah!
Like, oh man. Oh, that definitely ruined my
not pleasant.
Oh, it was.
He was acting like he was in Jurassic Park or something. It's all good.
City boy, hey, city boy. I looked downstairs, and when I used a shower, there was this huge, 180 mile per hour, whatever it is, voltage, wind air blower. And I was thinking about, would Gray mind if I just cleared my path and cleared everything free? Like, get away from me. I don't know. But the cook experience is about the South, so I'm embracing it all now. I can't wait to bring my son.
Eat something decent? Because he's always whipping up something when I go out there.
So listen to this, right? This is another great story. He's like, let's do some fried rice.
Yeah, the bear he served me was more of a cleanse.
Oh, no.
That was the bourbon you had.
That was the cleanse I had last time I was out there. Bear, you want a cleanse? Go have bear.
Give me a hangover. He and Chris Porter to this day swear they got a hangover for bear meat. I'm like, there's a whole bottle of bourbon gone, too.
No. It's not a hangover. It was a cleanse. Chris Porter and I both had a cleanse from eating the bear meat Gray cooked us.
That's good, right?
It was okay a couple days later.
Oh, wait.
Hey, get a sauna and some spring water, you'll be fine.
But I think it has something to do with Gray having a few bourbons while he was cooking.
Yeah, if you see the cookware and what the cookware goes through in the cleaning process, you might want to visit that, or gift him a dishwasher, one of those two things. That might help.
So you had a dishwasher in the cabin?
So part of the Gray Cook experience is you clean the dishes.
Well, you got to do what you got to do. You remember prevention? I'm an athletic trainer. Performance is part of my thing.
You just stepped up. You just sat there and watched TV and said, "Who's gonna do these dishes?"
Hey, I stepped up to the plate, baby. I want to be part. I want to help out. He wanted to cook fried rice, and I'm like, "That's great. Let's do fried rice." And
the guy from California coming in, he's gonna in middle of nowhere, he's gonna cook you fried rice.
Of course, man.
And I did too.
The way he described it, I was like, "That sounds great." With the peas and the kimchi, and you're not making it
pumpkin
with,
seeds, not, pumpkin and free seeds, range eggs.
Dude, free. Oh, this thing is nutrient dense. And here I am, I see him trying to make rice, and I'm like, and he's like with a measuring cup, and he's like, do you think that looks like? I'm like, do you not know how to cook rice? He goes, what do you mean? It's like, let an Asian man teach you how to cook rice. All right, walking over there. Teach him how to clean the rice. I teach him the line on the finger. You're like, all you got to do is let the rice settle. Bring
the line on the
up.
Finger?
You don't know this
that
trick
much
either.
Water over the rice.
So basically, you set your finger down, your middle finger down, and once you touch the top of the white rice, the water should meet That first, first line.
Really?
Yes.
Now
and that level of water is the perfect amount of water, no matter how big your bowl of rice is.
But he rinsed the rice four times.
I did.
Until the water's not a milky color. So he destarts the rice.
It was, and then on top of that, I was like getting ready to do regular water. He goes, well, why don't we just use some of this bone broth instead of the, so I'm like, all right. So I emptied out the water. We pour in the bone broth. So now it's cooking in this bone broth. This, I have never had fried rice this nutrient dense and this tasty with the aminos, soy sauce. It was like, it was crazy.
Grass-fed butter.
And after eating it, after eating it, I'm like, man, them Chinese don't know what they're missing. we got
bone broth in there. And
they really do. I got to go home and tell my peeps, you know, that, hey, I think there's a better way. And we can put chia seeds and
you
all
know
these
what the
other
secret
things
ingredient
in here.
Is? We had eight wasps in there. No, I'm just kidding.
I don't know what it was. That thing was delicious. The next morning, he breakfasted up a couple of
turned
eggs
it into
on
hash
top
with a fried egg on top.
All right. This is the Gray experience. What's the Brian experience? I wanted to get a piece of that.
In LA?
Of course.
Oh. You come to my house, all of a sudden, we are going to Malibu, all right? We got to check out Malibu. My boy, Sean Graham, has a beautiful ranch there. He's a stunt man out there, stunt coordinator. And we'd be over there doing quads, doing surfing. And he has these airstreams right in the middle of Indian canyons, right? There's nothing you can't do. So that'll be our outdoor stuff.
I want that experience.
We go there. Absolutely. Then we go to, I got to take you to one of my favorite places is this activity center. They have Tempest Free Running, which is learning parkour. You guys, I would have you guys do the salmon ladder because most people don't realize doing the salmon ladder is doable. You just have to pull really hard and throw your arms, get it up while you're up and, you know, click to the next spot. It's a very satisfying feeling. Running up.
I like to be satisfied.
Running up a warp.
Can we
wall.
Do it over water?
It's a soft pad. Yeah. You miss the you can fall and the bar is attached to these cords, so the bar doesn't fall on top of you. It's they've got it rigged for you to they're ready for you to fall.
Yeah.
And it's leap proof.
It's liability. Hey, they don't want to get sued.
The warp wall, you know, going up the warp wall, hanging on the edge. There's all those things. It's so much fun, but the exploration of play. So then after we get our exercise in, then what we'll have to do is, I mean, LA is not LA until you do a little bit of Hollywood, right? You know, we got to maybe go to a Riviera Golf Club or maybe check out a couple of the gyms that y'all have helped build out. You know, Lakeshore Learning, their headquarters is there. We built out a huge 5,000 square foot gym that is pretty much all, you know, this. I even screened their staff.
Lee's gonna make me wear sleeves.
Hey,
I'm just not gonna let you go.
and then we shoot a couple episodes of non-scripted television.
The Brian Experience.
Yeah, but I would definitely bring you guys to my house and cook for y'all, just like you've done for me. I would. There was no way. You guys are family. I love you guys.
We'll throw
so
some axes out back.
Oh yeah.
Complete the evening.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
So we mentioned a little bit, obviously, the West Coast and the Malibu experience. Is there anything that you've seen, like a trend or anything in personal training or in fitness industry right now that maybe just in the West Coast and maybe hasn't come across the country yet that you've seen and, you know, maybe could suggest to some of our listeners?
That's a great question. As far as West Coast living, I think everywhere is going boutique fitness. I don't think it's a California thing at all. I think you can see it in such a huge way. I mean, it's all small gyms now. And, you know, that boutique fitness culture, I love it. You know, I embrace it. I think you're going to always have, you know, other companies that do the, okay, the Orange Theories that, you know, they're taking the boutique small business owner gym and then, you know, they've made it into the franchises, right? The F45s, the Orange Theories, the Soul Cycles. That's a heavy coat in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. Then you have all these other people who just don't have the time. And so Peloton bikes and all these other, like, you know, mirrors and things are all, in, you know, starting to invade the home. There is a growth of people, especially with COVID, right? The people have started to build their own home gyms. and, you know, how can I best build my home gym? So for the professional out there, if you can assist your clients or actually say, I have the knowledge and the know-how to help you build the right gym for you, and then can support your clients in that way, be it, you know, either programs or I'm going to come to your house once a week and then you do the program on your own. Or, and now with apps and, you know, you have all the follow along programs, you can assess someone on an app, you can give them their workout recommendation, and then you can record a session with them and then they can just watch the percent, you know, so these outlets and avenues are in growth in California like crazy.
And one thing I think we can take from that is that the boutique fitness in a way can be one-on-one personalized, but usually it's a small group experience in mm-hmm. many cases. And what I want everybody out there to hear is the best way to do fitness in my mind is not a big group and not one-on-one. It's a small group. And Alan Cosgrove, this, we teach driving and shooting in small groups. Mm-hmm. We can't teach bicep curls in small groups. That's a thing where we have to have a one-on-one. But what I think is, there's a certain dynamic of energy in a small group. What John Terrine used to do with the Colts is we know a whole team has to work together, but using the movement screen and some other tests, he would platoon mobility, stability problems, asymmetries, and the small groups would get competitive working on their weak links, but the group would come together as a whole and function. And so I think there's just something, whether it's a top shelf boutique with very, very posh surroundings, or it's a military, or when Danielle and I are doing the volunteer work at the PE, our best classes are about 8 to 12. More people than that, somebody gets left behind. Less people than that, too many people take over all the time. But there's something about that group, because within those small groups is almost an example of everything, and they learn from each other as much as they learn from us, and they hear the coaching cues that everybody gets, not just that they get. So whether you're hearing what he's saying, I honestly think there's a recipe to that boutique situation where a small group of people can be instructed by a well-engaged coach and trainer, and it's way better than each of those people having a one-on-one session or being in a bigger group with five trainers. It's just, there's something magic about that. And so whatever service level you do that, whether it's in the park with sandbags or whether it's in high rent district, I think there's something we all need to lean into and learn. And even the correctives you and I have been really putting together, they could easily be transported into a small group, a runner's club that wants to do a group warm-up. It works, and there's something cool there.
If you really aren't gearing yourself for that small group effectiveness, because when you really navigate the waters of this experience, right, we are looking for connection. We are hardwired for connection. Brené Brown says that, right? We are hardwired to connect to people. And if fitness is a way to do it, or a small group of boutique, you're trying to find people who are, you know, like you. You share that energy, you know, that a coach is leading the room. We just did this yoga class together. You know, you start seeing the same people. You're starting to, this is your small little tribe that you're building. And, you know, the thing that I want to address people out there with all of this out, the boutiques and things, it can leave a lot of younger coaches feeling like I need to be in a boutique, or I need to have my own gym, or I need to have 100,000 followers to actually be relevant. And this is the biggest lie that any coach could tell us. I will start training when I have this, this, and this. And that's not the truth. You need to genuinely care about one client. One, get out there. Don't meet them because you have you need, oh, I need to get my following up so I can get my presence online up and I can do, like, are you crazy? You need to, if you want to train people, all right? Just go, just get somewhere. If you don't have a gym you're working at right now, then go to the boutiques, go to whatever, ask if they can volunteer, get yourself in and start cooking. Just start chopping vegetables if you have to, wipe floors, whatever, but learn and then learn and hang out with coaches that you like, because there are going to be gyms, there are going to be coaches, there's going to be people that you resonate with. Resonate is a physics term. It means that you share the same frequency. When they can come together, they can combine, make a better wave. If you don't share that frequency, that resonance, you cancel each other, and those are the people you feel worse around. Spend more time with the people you feel great around, and then you start to learn who are the people that resonate from you. those are your clients, people that you like surfing with, then great. Start a surf club. Help people gain their surf strength. That's what's happening in California because there's all these different activities. We've got great weather. That's why I pay the high taxes. Yeah, but I also see the unfolding of if you are passionate about coaching, coach people.
Yep.
I want to be the Gordon Ramsay. It's like there's restaurant owners out there and you have this menu that says, I can do this, I can do this, I can do this, I can do this. Have you tasted your own food?
Well, you know what? We started this on trends, but what you're saying transcends trends. So if the trend is boutique, small group, that's fine. But what you're talking about is what do you bring to it? Because it could be big groups later and it could be remote fitness pretty soon. But what you're saying is timeless. So whatever trend is going, bring that to the trend. You'll be at the front of it.
Care so much about your clients, right? Send them the message. You're thinking about them. If Greg Rose, I'm a golf guy and you're a coach, then be that coach that believes in someone else more than they believe in themselves, right? Be that coach, be that change, and you will see that following grow.
You mentioned
that following will then allow you to reveal what it is your small group business or small gym boutique is going to end up being. Is it going to be a dojo? Is it going to be, you know, Pilates and kettlebells are us? Whatever it is, it's an expression of your thing. And that's one of those California things that I really like, that people can do that. Rent is high. So, you know, hopefully you have some good backup, but you know, people are willing to pay for different experiences in California. And that's one of those novelties. They have paddleboard fitness. You have yoga in the marina with everybody on the paddleboards. You know, this is there. It's available to you. There's dog fitness or whatever it is. You work out with your dogs and you all go on a hike. So whatever it is your passion is, you should write that down, share it with other people, train them to be better at it. And I guarantee you, the more personal you can make it, the more you can assess someone with a movement screen, the more you can understand their body fat, the more you can help them with their nutrition and recovery, the more you can engage with them as their lifestyle coach, then you would have entered California's mode of action of lifestyle. We are lifestyle. We are out there and we want life. We want you playing, being active. And then we're going to yell at you when you're in front of us in traffic. That's it, Elliot.
Brian, this is awesome, man. Thank you so much for being here with us today. I can't wait till we do it again.
Hey, this is definitely the highlight of 2020. Yeah, it's been one heck of a year, but
we actually planned this visit a month ago, and you just now got to
plan. This was before when all of the stuff broke out. That was the week I was supposed to come. I had to cancel the flight, and it put me down. And then when this started going up again, I was like, "Am I going to have to cancel again?"
No.
And then that one side of me was like, "There is no way. We have projects to do. We got Move Print coming up.
There are axes to be thrown."
Heck yes.
And I wouldn't worry because once we got you here, I was like, we're not going to let him leave. So we'll be all right.
Yeah. I can get you a note.
I love every single part of this trip. I can't tell you, like, watching you guys, you know, yelling at each other yesterday.
No, we don't ever do that. Never
happened. Shut up. You know, like, I love my parents because they, you know, they divorced, they did, but this is not about a perfect life. I said adversity brings us to the better. You guys love this company. You guys love the people that we serve, and you are passionate about helping people just be better humans. And I, not just a practitioner, as someone who considers you guys mentors and leaders, my big brothers, I couldn't be happier than where I am right now and like in the journey and seeing things unfold and what FMS will end up being in the future for, you know, anybody that wants to move out there. And to be here at this moment, I can't thank you guys enough. So,
well, you're part of the family. Saw us locker room each other yesterday, so you know you're part of the family. Nobody gets to see backstage.
Anybody that's willing to fight for the growth of their child, because that's what we were fighting for. What I'm saying.
Yep.
It truly is a testament of what this company is built on. This company wasn't built on easy. You know, this company is built on love, and love is damn hard. And if you are willing to love hard in life, then you're willing to be that better person, right? Mm-hmm. So I love you guys for having me here. I look forward to the next one where we go over or maybe you guys visit me on the Love Hard podcast. and with the Dragon Master Bri online eventually when I get this all set up for me.
Okay.
We can all do right. that.
Yep. Done. Thanks for coming,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, guys. Thank you so much.
That'll do it for this episode of the Movement Podcast. Thanks for listening. And if you liked what you heard, please take a minute to subscribe, share, and review. If you want to learn more about our system and take the next step in your movement journey, visit us at movementpod.com. Until next time, remember to first move well, then move often.